Okay, our next presenter is Todd Mawinski. He's an associate partner with Newcomb & Boyd. He's going to be presenting on Beyond LEED Platinum, a case study for high-performance laboratory buildings. Todd has been with Newcomb & Boyd since 1997. During that time, he's worked on and focused on lab and vivarium projects, primarily for higher education projects. Let's welcome Todd.
Good morning. Can everyone hear me okay? Great. Okay. For the next 20 minutes, I'm going to talk to you about a project that has pretty much consumed my life for the last 3 years. So if I can summarize that for you in 20, that'll be a good success for me. Getting started here, first I want to start off by acknowledging some of the key players in this project. First off, Georgia Institute of Technology. This project was for Georgia Tech, and it's also my alma mater, so it was a lot of importance for them and me in this project. Cooper Carey was the architect of record, and one omission here on this slide, Lake Flato was the associate architect and the sustainability architect for the project, and they had a real important role in this project on the sustainability side, which we'll talk about here shortly. McCarthy Building Companies was the construction manager, and Heery International is the commissioning agent on the project. Quickly, this is our agenda. I'll just skip over that right away. So, first off, project background. This, like as I mentioned, is a project for the Georgia Tech campus. It is the engineered biosystems building. It is an extension of their existing bioquad, which is about four plus buildings adjacent to the lab site. And it's a collaboration between the colleges of science and engineering. And this particular project, what was really important for the college, or for the institute, I should say, is that the colleges of science and engineering really were integrated into one space where they could collaborate and work together. And to the point where it's not even, the building isn't subdivided by floors, it's really designed to have people clash into each other and collaborate. It's about 220,000 square feet, $90 million construction budget. And from a HVAC standpoint, well, let me just back up. Some of the functions of the building include a vivarium, computational research space, graduate research laboratories, and then on sort of the soft side, we have some seminar spaces and private offices and grad student work areas. From an HVAC standpoint, we really kind of have three primary systems. There is a 100% outside air system for the laboratories. There's a 100% outside air system for the lab or for the vivarium. And then what I call the other systems, there are various recirculating systems that serve the seminar room I mentioned, offices, et cetera. Quick note, we are going to focus today mostly on the air side systems. I don't want to ignore the water side, but for sake of time, we're just stick to the air side. But a quick note, on the water side, the building's served with campus chill water. On the heating side, we don't have a connection to campus steam, so we have two different heating systems. There's a modular high-efficiency steam boiler system that serves humidification and equipment loads, and then there's a condensing hot water boiler system that serves the hydronic heating systems. All right, so first off, really one of the heart of the presentation is you know, system selection and how we got to the end. And it all started with a sustainability charrette that was led by Lake Flato at the very beginning of the project. And you know, I'm a mechanical engineer. I hear the word charrette, and I start going into an unhappy place. I'm a very much fact-driven. I just want to get to the end. And so I have to admit, going into the sustainability charrette, I was a little apprehensive about, oh, we're just gonna have to hold hands all day and sing kumbaya, and this is gonna be a huge waste of time. The opposite happened. I was really pleasantly surprised. The sustainability charrette was a great collaboration where the owner, and by the owner I mean facilities, capital planning, EH&S, I mean everybody at Georgia Tech was there. The construction manager was there, we as engineers were there, the architects were there, civil engineer. I mean, I think there was probably as many people in that sustainability charrette as there are in this room right now, which you might think would be tough to manage, but it really worked out, and it really gave everybody an opportunity to talk about what was important to them for this project, and then gather up all the information and consolidate it and really drive towards a unified set of goals. Whereas, you know, on previous projects, you get the project, you go back to the office, you come up with some ideas, and maybe you talk to the owner, and you kind of just do what you think is best. But in this case, we really were able to hone in on some very specific things that the owner felt was really important. We did talk about the whole gamut of energy, water, lighting, interior environment. Again, today we're just really focus on some of the energy parts of the project. All right, so this first quote here, I'm going to go ahead and read from a slide, even though that's a no-no. This was the main goal from the energy standpoint that came out of the charrette. And it says here, Georgia Tech would like for this project to be the most sustainable building on campus, as their goal is for every new project on their campus to be the most sustainable building they've ever built. And if you could think about what kind of challenge that is, the project that preceded this one was a classroom building. It maybe had one or two labs in it, maybe a few more, but primarily a recirculating air system. So my project comes back and we have a primarily lab project. So we had quite a challenge in order to try to surpass the previous project. So for some specific energy goals that we came out with, you can see here, first, drive the air change down, minimize 100% outside air systems, consider all the heat recovery options available to us, use demand and occupancy control. And then what that all led to was they wanted an energy use intensity that was 25% better than the existing BioQuad. Now, we did have some lead goals, and I'll talk about that later, but the important point here is we didn't want to chase lead points. We wanted to do what was right for the project. And one of those things was to baseline that existing BioQuad and really see what that was doing to try to get to a realistic and aspirational goal for our project. So we'll talk about how we achieve that later on. So the first thing here, driving the air change rate down. Here in Georgia, the University System of Georgia is governed by the Board of Regents, and they have some laboratory guidelines. Right before this project went underway, they reduced their occupied air change rate from 8 to 6, and then their unoccupied air change rate was at 4. And everyone involved with the project felt that that was as low as we really wanted to go for this project. So there wasn't really a lot of work that we had to do there. But on the vivarium side, for all of you who know vivarium design, the ALAC guidelines require that you maintain 10 to 15 air changes in the animal holding rooms, which is usually much greater than what the heat load in the space is. So we really wanted to focus on how we could drive those air change rates down. Now there's a couple things at work here. First, if you have ventilated cage racks, that is the primary mode of containment. So the ALAC requirement really applies to the cage rack, not the room. But in our project, we have everything from mice to pigs. So pigs aren't going to be in a ventilated cage rack. So we had to make sure that our system was flexible so that we could get the 15 air changes, but then also switch down to something lower as appropriate. So what we did here, and we can kind of, it's hard to see, but this screen here, rather than have the users have to call up the building operations staff, they have their own computer that's tied into the campus control system, and it's password protected, and it gives them a window into just their vivarium systems. And for each room, they can go in and adjust set points and the air change rate. So when a room, if research ends in a room, or if they're switching from pigs to rats or whatever it is, the users themselves can go in and say, hey, we're done with this room. Let's switch it down from 15 to 8 to 6, whatever they feel comfortable with, so that when the room is sitting empty or not being used in a environment that needs a lot of air changes, they can really turn those air changes down. All right, our next goal was to minimize 100% outside air systems. And, you know, right off the bat, the easy way to do that is we're going to separate labs and vivariums from the offices. And I mentioned that at the beginning. So all the office systems are on recirculating systems and completely separate from the laboratory systems. Now, the next part was how do we minimize 100% outside air in the laboratories? And what we decided was to use or was to explore chill beams. And, you know, chill beams aren't the right technology for every project, but they are a good technology for the right project. So what we did was we looked at our building layout and how it worked out and started looking at the heat loads versus air change rates versus makeup exhaust requirements and really trying to figure out where they made sense. And what we found is that the building, the laboratory part of the building, is split into two main areas. There's a large open lab that has lots of fume hoods, and then there are very small individual support labs, little modules that are roughly 15 by 30. And because they are so small, the minimum air change rate in that space, 6 air changes, was not enough to satisfy the cooling load. So those were great applications for the chill beams. Conversely, inside the open labs, where we had lots of fume hoods and high air change rates, the chill beams didn't make sense. Even with all the fume hoods at minimum flow, there was more than enough air to satisfy the heating load. So what we wound up with is a hybrid system of a central laboratory, 100% outside air system that serves both open and support labs that have chill beams and not chill beams. And how we did that was we are supplying 55 degree air to all the spaces, and that is the first stage of cooling, even in spaces with chill beams. As the heat load in the space increases, then we open up the chill water valve on the chill beam to allow for additional cooling. As cooling load in the space decreases, we have supply air temperature reset to allow the discharge air temperature from the energy recovery units to increase so that we try to minimize our reheat loads as much as possible. So we were able to kind of come up with a system that was, I would say, maybe a little non-traditional in that we didn't have chill beams across the board. We only used them where they made sense. And as you can see here, the upshot was that we reduced the 100% outside air systems by 60,000 CFM. Now that had an equipment savings to be sure, but really what that helped us was minimizing our penthouse and minimizing our footprint on lab floors with shaft space. We were really able to decrease the amount of space in the building that was required for MEP and have that space for program use. Next part, of course, any lab building needs to consider heat recovery, and we did review many different options. The first off, on the lab systems, we worked very early on to talk about enthalpy wheels and where they would be appropriate. What we ultimately decided was that we did not want to put fume hood exhaust air through the enthalpy wheels. Now, I think we support that in the right application, you can put fume hood exhaust through an enthalpy wheel, provided you have EH&S buy-off and you work with the wheel manufacturer to make sure that cross-contamination isn't going to be a problem. But for Georgia Tech, we were too concerned about the unknown nature of what chemicals might get used in the building for the life of the building to take that chance. So what we wound up with on the exhaust side is two systems, and we really have three energy recovery units. There's two that serve general exhaust loads and one that serves fume hood exhaust loads. So the fume hood exhaust energy recovery unit is a heat pipe, and the two general exhaust are heat wheels. But the three energy recovery units work together in parallel to meet the to serve the spaces, and then the exhaust systems sort of work independently. The energy recovery units on the general exhaust side have internal fans, whereas the fume hood exhaust goes to a high induction, high plume type exhaust fan system. So that is the laboratory system. Now on the vivarium system, this is where things got a little interesting. I mentioned earlier that the high air change rate is a problem in laboratories or in vivarium systems. Exacerbating that issue is that the program requirement that we were required to meet from a space temperature and humidity standpoint in the vivarium was 68 degrees and 50% relative humidity. So that's about a 48 degree dew point. So coming off of our cooling coil in the animal air handling unit, we're coming off at 48 degrees. But we have 15 air changes in some spaces down in the space. So that is far greater than we need to serve any type of of heating load in the space, which means we're going to be reheating all the time. We don't want to reheat. So what we came up with is this, what I call a two-stage runaround loop. And the reason we're using a runaround loop versus a wheel is, I don't know if anyone has ever been into a vivarium, but the exhaust is not something you ever want to smell, ever. I mean, it kind of haunts me at night. So we didn't want to have any chance of cross-contamination, so we did this runaround coil. And the way this works is, and I'm going to try to use the mouse here. I hope you all can see it. Yeah. All right. So we have a heat recovery unit that is a box with a fan and a traditional runaround coil. But then what happens is we take that relatively cool water that's coming out of the unit after the exhaust stream has gone through it. And the first place it goes in the unit is a reheat coil. So we come off the coil at 48, go across the fan, pick up some fan heat, and then we reheat here at the reheat coil with a three-way valve. And what that does is it takes us from, for 48 the coil, maybe 52 off the fans, maybe 56, 58. It's an active control sequence, so we'll be changing it based on the needs of the facility. But the point is we're getting free reheat for at least part of the air. And then you can see here these coils are in series. And when that water went into the reheat position, what was already relatively cool water just had 48 or 52 degree air pass through it. So that water gets cooled even more. So now when we get back to the pre-cool coil, we can recover some of that cooling we had to use to dehumidify the air to help us pre-cool the air. And what we're hoping, and haven't been able to validate yet just because the systems aren't quite up and running, or haven't been completely commissioned yet, I should say, is that on the most humid of days, we think that we'll get enough cooling in the glycol stream that we ought to be able to get some latent cooling on the pre-cool coil, which is not something you can traditionally do with a normal runaround coil. So we will keep our eyes on that to see how it works, but that is our mission. And you can see here the reheat is really where this system paid off, saving 30,000 kilowatt hours per year. So demand control. A building like this is going to be occupied all hours of the day, but at varying occupancies, depending on how researchers are going to want to react. So demand control based on occupancy was very important. So what we have in every lab is your traditional lighting occupancy sensor, but the HVAC system ties into that occupancy sensor. So when someone leaves and the lights turn off, that sends a signal to the building control system to say, hey, I'm unoccupied, change my air change rate. So we'll go down from 6 to 4. So you could have a lab support module at noon on Tuesday, and if there's nobody working in there, that's down to 4 air changes and at a setback temperature. Somebody comes in, the air change, the occupancy sensor engages, the air change rate increases, and the set points tie back in. Additionally, we have supplier temperature reset that I mentioned. And one of the things, and this kind of speaks to the not chasing lead points. This was an owner-driven idea of adding an automatic sash closer to the fume hoods. This is not something I had really even been very familiar with before this project, but it has a sensor at the top of the hood. If someone walks away for more than 30 minutes, the sash automatically closes. It costs about $3,000 a year, and if you have great users in your building, it doesn't save you any money, because if they do what they're supposed to do and close the sash when they walk away, everything's great. Now, if you have users who do not do that, the payback can be as little as, I put 6 months to 1 year to be conservative. The payback can be almost 3 months if you have bad users who leave their sashes open all the time. So this was really a no-brainer for Georgia Tech to add to the fume hood cost. All right, so as I mentioned, our EUI, so the goal, I'll remind you, was to improve our project would improve upon the BioQuad average EUI by 25%. So when we took all the information, that was the goal we set during the charrette before we knew what the answer was going to be once we got into it. So when we did do the math on the BioQuad EUI, we came up with a 415 kBTUs per square foot per year as the average. And 25% of that was, about 300, about 300 from an EUI standpoint. And we looked at that and said, well, gosh, that's actually not very good. So we're going to do better than our aspirational goal of 25% better than the BioQuad. The lead baseline EUI, this would be the ASHRAE 90.1 Appendix G, if you worked it out, was 361 kB2 per square foot per year. So as designed, our goal is 222 kB2 per square foot per year. So from a comparison standpoint, that is 38.5% better than ASHRAE 90.1 Appendix G, based on energy. On cost, it's more like 33%, because energy rates here in Georgia are pretty darn good. And then compared to our aspirational 25% goal against the existing BioQuad, we are actually at 46.5%. All right, so lastly, we have all these measures in place to save energy from the design side. So how are we going to validate that? The project is metered. There's probably more meters on this project than the last four projects I did put together. We have, as an example, we have 18 different water meters on the project. And the goal here is to be able to really fine-tune and troubleshoot systems once the building is operational. We have what I call macro and micro metering. So macro is sort of your traditional, okay, we've set up the electrical loads for pumps, lights, process, and that gives us big picture. But then on the micro side, we are monitoring energy recovery performance, you know, across the wheels, across the coils. We have interfaces into the variable frequency drives so we can get all the information they have to offer us. And really, anything on the project that could have a BACnet connection has it. So we can really talk and see information from every piece of equipment to really get a good feel for what everything is doing on a real-time basis. So, conclusions here that, like I mentioned, the charrette at the beginning of the project was, I can't stress enough how important that was to the design process to really, get me out of my bubble, get the whole team out of their, this is what my goal for the project is, and get everyone to really collaborate and come up with an overall goal for the project. And with that, I will open it up to questions.
Thank you. Lee Ryback, P2S Engineering. I'm curious, with the chill beams you had in the non-lab areas, when you went to the low air changes, were there problems during the startup and commissioning of those? And if so, how were they resolved?
So I may have misspoke. There are no chill beams in areas that are not labs. In traditional office systems, we have just regular traditional VAV systems. What I was saying is that in support labs, we have chill beams are tied into the occupancy sensors. And when you go from six air changes, or when the occupancy sensor notices occupancy is gone, it goes from six air changes in the room to four air changes. Now, that is a good point. What happens at that point is that the airflow through the chill beam goes below the minimum that the chill beam manufacturer would recommend for the chill beam to work. And so what the way the sequence works on that is, if you're unoccupied, if for some reason God forbid we get a condensate sensor, we have condensate sensors on the chill beam, but more importantly, if the temperature in the space isn't maintained, then it ends the unoccupied mode and kicks it back up to six air changes. Yeah. And to speak to your commissioning, commissioning is in process. I don't believe there have been any issues with that, but it's ongoing.
Yeah. Hoy Bohannon, Hoy Bohannon Engineering. Todd, great presentation. You've got a state-of-the-art advanced system. So my question is, what's the strategy for sustaining that system in the future? Operator training, you know, what's the are there new qualifications for people that have the wherewithal to deal with all the inputs that you're giving them in terms of the metering and performance, and what's that strategy, and what's the expectation on how that's going to work?
That's a great question. So we have two sort of things in place. One, on the training side, what we specified was one set of training now, which is the building is wrapping up, and then a second set of training to happen 3 months from now. And we're kind of negotiating where that training level will be, but the idea is that after the facility folks have been in there for a little while and gotten their hands dirty, to have another round of training. So, okay, I wasn't paying attention when you showed me that video, but now that I've been trying to change that belt, I've got more questions. So that's one way. On the sustainability side, I should have mentioned this earlier. One of the great things about Georgia Tech, it has a mechanical engineering school. They have a professor, his name's Dr. Jeter, who is very involved in ASHRAE and all the HVAC studies at Tech. He runs, he has grad students that take our model and create their own models of buildings on campus and then tune them based on the real results coming out of the building so that they can use the model to help predict what the performance should be based on weather, occupancy, that sort of thing. Does that answer?
Oh, yeah, that's a great answer. So I've got a follow-up question
Sure.
now. So if you are in a situation where you don't have grad student oversight of how the building performs, which I think is a great strategy, what would you recommend in terms of operator qualifications? Because there's all kinds of ranges of abilities of operators. Was that ever discussed, and do you have any thoughts on that?
I do. We didn't really discuss it specifically for this project, since we kind of know what Georgia Tech's capabilities are. But on other projects, that is certainly a concern and would perhaps drive you to not use some of these advanced technologies. So, I mean, it's a conversation for sure.
Great. Thank you.
Hi, Jason Urso with Tie and Bond Consulting Engineers. Just curious, what was your discharge air temperature off of the runaround reheat coil?
It's designed to be 48 to maintain our 68 degree 50% space temperature, and that's using campus chill water. And I can't remember if we have a 10 row. It's at least I think it's a 10 row chill water coil. And that's about as good as you can get off of a traditional campus chill water system with a chill water. There is a supplier temperature reset strategy so that if a number of spaces are in reheat or we don't need the dehumidification, we can raise that 48 degree temperature up. And then as I mentioned, that other reheat coil in the unit helps us get from 48 to something more like 56, 58. For space cooling, so it's cool, dry air. It's very similar to the unit is very similar to a traditional dual wheel passive dehumidification system.
Okay, so just so I understand, you're coming off the cooling coil at 48.
That's right.
And then you're reheating up to 56.
56, 58.
And is that reheat coil? Did you say it's primarily for supplier temperature reset?
It doesn't really reset, but it's primarily to minimize reheat at individual
right exactly coils. Okay yeah. Right, okay, thank you.
Sure.
Jeff Stein, Taylor Engineering. Did you consider as one of your energy efficiency strategies to transfer excess ventilation air from the office spaces to the lab spaces?
We did, and it really didn't work out for us from a air balance. I mean, we are transferring some amount of air from the office into labs just from a pressurization standpoint, but it wasn't a makeup air strategy for us. One thing the building itself has, it doesn't have an atrium, but it has a series of two-story stairwells that interconnect all the floors. So in effect, it, under normal circumstances, the whole building is open to itself. And we were concerned about keeping the building positively pressurized. So the outside air that we're sending out to the office area, we're trying to keep out there to keep the offices positive to the labs and then keep the building positive to the outside. Is that?
Interesting presentation, interesting design. What did you do about sizing of ductwork and coils in terms of getting the energy savings in the fans, which is a no-brainer and requires no training? It works no matter who is operating the system.
Right. Yeah. Our cooling coil phase velocity is 400 feet per minute. 400 feet per minute on the cooling coil. On our ductwork sizing, I would have liked to have gotten better than we did. And so I agree, low pressure design is a very smart way to reduce fan energy. Like you said, it doesn't require any training. It's working 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. I would say we were not able to utilize that as much as we would have liked, and mostly from a space constraint standpoint. All right. Oh, there's maybe one more.
Bruce Flanagan, Methodist Hospital, Houston, Texas. On your vivarium, did you use the large air handling unit serving multiple floors concept, or did you have the smaller units and on individual floors?
Yeah, well, our vivarium is a single floor, and there's a single system with 100% redundant units that serve the vivarium.
What size unit is it?
They are each around 27,000 CFM. All right, well, thank you.